you know, still allow him to exercise this immense pressure on the people that he's trying to control without ever stepping over the line of violating human rights. So that makes him a very different kind of dictator.
Professor, last year, Fox News host Tucker Carlson took a show to Hungary. I had said it was Sean Hannity, but it was Carlson, where yes. Tucker Carlson repeatedly praised Orban's immigration policies. This is what he said.
That is exactly why Democrats become hysterical when you mention the obvious successes that are on display here in Hungary on the immigration question. They don't want you to know that there's an option to the chaos and filth and crime growing all around us. We don't have to live like that anymore. Actually, we could have a functioning country.
So if you can comment on this and the whole white nationalist trend in the United States, some of the people actually modeling themselves on Orban as Orban followers.
Yeah, in fact, it's exactly on immigration that you see the sharpest parallels, you know, between Orban and Trump. So, you know, if you know the what Trump did to stop immigration, he first built a wall. Well, Viktor Orban first built a fence. Then Trump pushes the people who are seeking asylum back across the border to wait in this kind of limbo before they can get into the country. Orban set up these things he called transit zones, which again were a kind of limbo as people awaited, you know, entry. The similarities between Trump and Orban are so extreme that there was even a point about 6 months before the U.S. started doing it when Orban started separating parents and children. Now, they didn't lose track of which parents were connected to what kids, as happened here, but they decided that they had no human rights obligation to feed the parents in these transit camps, but they did have an international obligation to feed the children.
We have 10 seconds, Professor.
They took the children, fed them, and then brought them back to their parents so the kids couldn't share food. So all of that was stuff Trump copied.
Well, Professor Kim Lane Shepley, Professor of Sociology and International Affairs at Princeton University, specializing in the rise and fall of constitutional government, focusing on Hungary. That does it for our show. We'll do part two with Professor Shepley and post online at democracynow.org. Democracy Now!, produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Messiah Rhodes. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Finance Committee meets the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify that a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, more Oregonians are at risk of losing the roof over their heads. Nursing homes are suffering from a lack of workers.
Hospital emergency rooms start to back up because beds weren't available because we didn't have enough skilled nursing facilities.
Restaurant workers are also feeling a pandemic pinch, trying to get their workplace rights into law. And relief may be on the way for airline travelers who are getting booted and delayed as they try to fly again. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, August 4th, 2022. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. More people are losing their homes in Oregon or are at risk for it. KBOO's Jeffrey Wade breaks down the reasons why.
Eviction rates are rising in Oregon as resources for renters facing houselessness are diminishing. As rents continue to rise in the state, pandemic-era rental assistance and eviction protections have begun to dwindle. The situation has only worsened by investors snatching up real estate amid a COVID-depressed housing market. The greater demand for housing, coupled with minimal rent control options, is allowing landlords to hike up rent. In Portland, average rent for a one-bedroom apartment rose 34% last year. Currently, roughly half of all Oregon renters spend at least 30% of their income on rent, a statistic that places them below the federal standard for living affordability. During the height of COVID-19 shutdowns, eviction moratoriums were put in place, and Oregon Housing and Community Services dispersed nearly $400 million in emergency rental support. OHCS funding went to 60,829 households and helped keep at least 130,000 people in their homes. Once eviction protections were lifted, many households still faced owing back rent amid ongoing pandemic economic instability. In January 2022, 806 evictions were filed, while in the first half of July, there were over 630. Most of these filings were a result of non-payment. Experts, advocates, and policymakers have been predicting an eviction crisis that for many has seemed to arrive. Kim McCarty, executive director for the Community Alliance of Tenants, said, quote, "Eviction rates are steadily increasing, and there's every reason to believe that they will continue to go up," end quote. McCarty maintains the state is bracing for two significant spikes of evictions, one in October, when all emergency evictions expire, and the second in January, when landlords can increase rent. Tenants will also be facing a three-day notice of eviction versus the 10-day notice under Senate Bill 892, which is set to expire this fall. With the KBOO Evening News, I'm Jeffrey Wade.
Athletic directors and coaches in Oregon are required to take new training ahead of the fall sports season. In efforts to stop racist and discriminatory incidents, the Oregon School Activities Association, or OSAA, created the new training program following an increase in racist incidents at sporting events last school year. OSAA's program is called Interrupting and Preventing Discriminatory Acts. It will feature a presentation that reinforces what discriminatory behaviors look like and how to respond to and prevent them. The training focuses on how coaches, officials, and even event workers must respond to racist incidents, and that any discriminatory language or behavior is properly reported. Multiple racist acts were reported at OSAA events last year, with both Medela and Clatskanie High Schools being put on probation until later this school season. Sandy High School was also sanctioned by OSAA following reports of racist taunts during a basketball game. If the new training is not completed by all coaches, athletic directors, and other officials, schools may have to pay fines and may be required to forfeit games. Air travelers experiencing delays or significant changes to their itineraries may get some financial relief. KBOO's Josh Salem has more on that story.
The Transportation Department just announced a proposal to require airlines to offer passengers a refund if their flight schedule is changed significantly or the airline makes major changes to their itinerary. At present, airlines are required to offer refunds to passengers whose flights are canceled or significantly changed, but those conditions have never been formally defined. The rule announced yesterday would require airlines to give refunds if their departure or arrival time changes by 3 hours or more for a domestic flight or 6 hours or greater for an international one. The airlines are also liable if they change the departure or arrival airport, add a stop, or cause, quote, a significant downgrade, end quote, to the traveler's experience by switching to a different type of airplane. The rules also apply to non-refundable tickets, which are usually cheaper and are often used by non-business travelers. Airlines appear to prefer to give travel vouchers instead of refunds. The Transportation Department also wants airlines and ticket agents to give vouchers that don't expire for passengers who can't travel due to health reasons or because borders are closed. The proposal will be open for public commentary for 90 days. Opposition by the airlines is expected. They've challenged the Transportation Department's authority to force them to pay refunds. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg said, quote, "When Americans buy an airline ticket, they should get to their destination safely, reliably, and affordably. This new proposed rule would protect the rights of travelers and help ensure they get timely refunds they deserve from the airlines," end quote. Consumer complaints filed with the department rose nearly sevenfold in 2020. 87% concerned refunds. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Mushrooms containing the psychedelic compound psilocybin will soon be available to the public. Oregon is finalizing rules and licensing requirements for their administration and production. Oregon Psilocybin Services is scheduled to have rules for the accessibility of magic mushrooms in place by December 31st. The state can begin taking license applications on January 2, 2023. The product would be available to people 21 years or older. It would not require a prescription or a referral from a provider. Health experts are addressing several aspects of the legalization of psilocybin services within a framework that will include developing facilitation training programs and creating a product tracking system. Unlike cannabis-based products, magic mushrooms will not be available for purchase to take at home. Instead, people will be able to take psilocybin in a controlled licensed service center overseen by trained and licensed facilitators. This all comes after Oregon voters passed ballot measure 109, the Oregon Psilocybin Services Act, back in November 2020. Proponents of psilocybin say it has therapeutic value when properly administered, especially in accelerating healing for those with distressing emotional symptoms such as depression, OCD, PTSD, and anxiety. There has been some pushback to this legislation, most recently with Clackamas County Commissioners. They placed a temporary local ban on psilocybin services and manufacturing on the November ballot. And you can get more information on OHA's Oregon's Psilocybin Services website. So far, the child care industry is left out of a new U.S. Senate package. A version of last year's Build Back Better proposal included $400 billion for child care and preschool. But as the Senate puts together a new package addressing climate change and health care costs, missing from the negotiations is support for the child care industry. As Eric Tegedoff reports, it's in a fragile state.
Child care advocates say there's a big hole in the reconciliation package being considered by the U.S. Senate. Supports for the child care industry are not yet part of negotiations on a bill known as the Inflation Reduction Act, which does include provisions to address climate change and the cost of health care. Gabriela Quintana with Seattle-based think tank Economic Opportunity Institute says the industry is in dire straits.
It's really disheartening that once again we have to beg for some attention to these really important issues that are so closely correlated to our economy and our recovery from COVID and all that's been going on.
Earlier versions of President Joe Biden's Build Back Better framework, which has been scaled back significantly in the Inflation Reduction Act, included provisions to support families and child care workers. Washington State has lost child care providers since 2017, despite an increase in the number of children, according to Child Care Aware of Washington. Quintana says one area policymakers should zero in on is pay for people in the industry, who often make poverty wages.
Given how fragile the system is, I think we really need to focus on childcare teacher wages to ensure that they are sticking to the profession that they love and that they want to do. They're just not able to earn the wages, and so a lot of them are leaving the industry to go get other jobs.
Quintana says some childcare teachers leave for jobs in public school instead. The Inflation Reduction Act could get a vote as soon as this week. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Restaurant workers are seeing legislation that would outline a set of rights in their workplaces. According to a report from the University of California, Berkeley, this comes at a time when a little more than half of restaurant workers are leaving or planning to leave their jobs. KBOO's Grant Button has more.
Restaurant workers have been fleeing the industry throughout the Great Resignation with no end in sight. In order to codify some of the necessities for better working conditions, Restaurant Opportunity Centers United has been working to develop the Restaurant Workers' Bill of Rights. This set of rights seeks to provide restaurant workers with livable wages, better access to health care, a safe work environment, and participation in governance. Teo Reyes with Restaurant Opportunity Centers United believes there's a need for this bill.
The fundamental impetus for this is for us to bring workers together to build power. And one of the milestones will be getting these bills introduced at the federal level in Congress, at the state level, and at the municipal level, and then advancing components of those as the opportunity presents itself.
This Bill of Rights will be introduced to Congress in September. Months of outreach to restaurant workers across the U.S. helped determine what should go into the bill. New York's own restaurant industry has seen 120,000 people leaving for different jobs, according to a report from Cal Berkeley's Food Labor Research Center. This was due in part to the low wages and rising prices that occurred during the COVID-19 pandemic. In New York City, workers from any sector can see what they are entitled to under the city's Workers' Bill of Rights. While the bill will be introduced later this year, Reyes believes this document will need to be updated to reflect the most current needs of restaurant workers. He shared some gripes workers had, providing a clear path on what changes should be made.
It breeds a lot of unhealthy behaviors, like excessive drinking and late night eating. I'm not as healthy and I miss large parts of the next day while catching up on sleep. I think that restaurants should provide healthcare and dental care. People complain about rude customers. People complain about scheduling, like 2 weeks notice to schedule even in a small business.
Not all of the survey's answers were negative. Many of those surveyed praised their coworkers, and others felt it could be a highly lucrative industry, something Reyes hopes to maintain through establishing this Bill of Rights. For KBOO News and the Public News Service, I'm Grant Button.
A nursing home staffing shortage is creating backlogs for hospitals. Nationally, the residential long-term care industry has lost 235,000 workers since the onset of the global pandemic. Now, a new Economic Policy Institute report shows that workers in residential long-term care facilities face low pay and poor working conditions. KBOO's Eleanor Trombla has more on the story.
A new Economic Policy Institute report links staffing shortages in residential long-term care facilities in Nebraska and across the nation to low pay and poor working conditions. The median pay for caregivers at just over $15 an hour is significantly below the national median of $20 an hour. Todd Stubendeck with AARP Nebraska says lack of staff can lead to significant negative health impacts for residents.
Decreased physical ability, more rates of infections, more falls, and then more hospitalizations. So tackling the staffing issue is fundamental to ensuring that we are providing good quality care to long-term care residents.
Long-term care workers are also less likely to be covered by employer-provided retirement and health insurance benefits. Even before COVID, staffing at nursing homes failed to meet demand, and the industry lost 235,000 workers since the onset of the pandemic. AARP analysts found that one-fifth of all nursing homes have reported a lack of sufficient staff every month since the summer of 2020. Lack of staffing at nursing homes is also impacting Nebraska's hospitals, according to Nebraska Hospital Association President Jeremy Nordquist. When long-term care facilities don't have adequate staffing, he says hospital patients can't be discharged and that bed isn't available for the next patient who needs it.
We've seen recently, just in the Omaha area, hospital emergency rooms start to back up because beds weren't available because we didn't have enough skilled nursing facilities and nursing homes around the state to take those patients.
The report calls for expanding public funding to ensure higher pay and better working conditions to attract and retain experienced and committed workers. States and localities can also establish industry-specific worker standards boards to recommend changes on minimum wages and working conditions. Stubendeck adds that helping Nebraskans access home-based care would also ease demand.
We know people want to stay in their homes as long as possible or in the lowest level of care. So people are staying in their homes and getting care and not having to go to long-term care facilities, which tend to be more expensive. And so bolstering that home and community-based care is one solution.
For KBOO News and the Public News Service, I'm Eleanor Trombla.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather, clear skies, down to 56. And tomorrow's weather, sunny skies, up to 85. Today in history, on August 4, 1932, Warren G. Harding, the former president of the U.S., lay in a funeral train as people in groups of hundreds bared their heads and bowed. Military members escorted his remains from the White House to Washington for the funeral. Harding's successor was Calvin Coolidge. For some perspective, I talked to Ohio State University history professor Dr. Chris Nichols.
The Harding administration was beset with scandals. Harding was known for favoring his allies in the cabinet. So you had something called the Teapot Dome scandal, which was about fossil fuel access. And it sounds actually quite knowable in terms of corruption, who gets access to what, who gets kickbacks. But the broader story of that moment is the Republican presidencies that follow Wilson of the 20s were Harding, Coolidge, and Hoover were attempts to peel back a kind of more progressive state and to have less regulation and to prioritize, as Calvin Coolidge said, the business of America is business. And so you saw these three presidencies who really prioritized private and corporate rights. And part of that era's inward focus is what people sometimes talk about in terms of isolationism, you know, not being so invested in foreign policy, in alliances. The U.S. doesn't join the League of Nations. The U.S. actually conducts a separate peace with Germany because it doesn't formally finish the Versailles Treaty. The final U.S. troops come out of Europe in 1923, in fact. So it was in a state of war, believe it or not. So that's on the Harding Watch. And through those years, you get, you know, rising inequality, speculation, buying on margin, the stuff that leads to the Depression, essentially. A split in the economy where you have, you know, a real economy of really problematic farm prices and debt, and what's beginning to be the Dust Bowl in those years, and then you get a kind of overheated high economy of speculation in the stock market, and the two diverge is the way people often talk about it. And then you get the so-called crack up of, you know, the crashes in 29, but most observers, really astute observers, were getting a sense that there was something really wrong with the economy in 1927 and 1928. I had dinner with a leading businessman in Oregon a few days ago, and he was saying, you know, one thing that's interesting is that we seem to be moving towards a recession of our own making in the U.S. right now, because most of the underlying economy is actually pretty good, but the press keeps talking about inflation, there's a war in Ukraine, but the main problem for him is inequality, and the comparison for him is the 1920s.
And that was Ohio State University history professor Dr. Chris Nichols. President Biden signs an executive order calling for Medicaid waivers for abortion travel. State election officials testify about harassment and threats. And senators talk about the bipartisan Electoral Count Reform Act. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Enduring these threats creates a near constant strain of anxiety and stress on our work. The status quo is unsustainable and unacceptable.
Michigan Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson testified before a congressional committee Wednesday at the first ever hearing on the safety of the nation's election workers. Benson said she and her staff are facing an unprecedented wave of unrelenting harassment and threats. Officials from the Department of Justice said the FBI's process for receiving reports of violent threats against workers wasn't built to handle the high volume. Democratic West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin and Republican Maine Senator Susan Collins testified about the need to reform the law governing the counting of electoral votes in presidential elections. Reforms proposed by the two senators include clearly defining the vice president's lack of authority to dispute election results.
The idea that any vice president could have the power to unilaterally accept, reject, change, or halt the counting of electoral votes is antithetical to our constitutional structure and basic democratic principles.
Manchin called for urgency in passing the bipartisan Electoral Count Reform Act.
As we saw on January the 6th, 2021, a lot of the fixes established by the original Electoral Count Act are not merely outdated, but actually serve as the very mechanisms that bad actors have zeroed in on as a way to potentially invalidate presidential election results.
President Biden signed an executive order Wednesday directing his health secretary to consider actions to assist patients traveling out of state for abortions.
I commit to the American people that we're doing everything in our power to safeguard access to health care, including the right to choose that women had under Roe v. Wade, which was ripped away by this extreme court.
Taiwan is now bracing for China to begin live military drills today, an escalation prompted by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's meeting this week with Taiwanese lawmakers, where she expressed U.S. support for the country's sovereignty. China maintains the island is a part of China. Director of Asia Engagement at the think tank Defense Priorities, Lyle Goldstein, on the impact of Pelosi's visit.
A lot of people in Washington make the mistake of turning this into a messianic, you know, struggle between good and evil. That's a wrongheaded approach that will quickly lead us into World War III with another nuclear power.
I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
Tribes are hosting Secretary Deb Haaland stops on the Road to Healing Tour. Nez and Nigrin top the Navajo national primary election. Kansas voters choose to protect abortion rights. And the historic Pine Ridge Station seeks a new building. With these stories and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Little Traverse Bay Bands of Ottawa Indians are hosting the Michigan stop of Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland's Road to Healing Tour. The tour is part of the Interior Department's investigation into federal Indian boarding schools, which was launched last year. 35 tribal nations from Michigan, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Iowa are expected to participate in the August 13th event. This will be Haaland's second stop on the tour to gather testimony from boarding school survivors and descendants. The first stop was last month in Oklahoma, where former students recounted traumatic memories at boarding school, including physical, mental, and sexual abuse. Haaland has expressed the need to gather testimony, acknowledging it won't be easy, but says it's a necessary part of the investigation. Trauma-informed support will be on site. The year-long tour will include stops in Hawaii, Arizona, and South Dakota. Unofficial results from the Navajo Nation's primary election on Tuesday show the top two candidates for Navajo Nation president are current president Jonathan Nez and Boo Nigrin. There were 15 candidates on the ballot for president of the tribe. The Navajo Times reports as of early Wednesday morning, Nez had more than 17,000 votes and Nigrin more than 12,000. More than 47,000 voters reportedly took part in the primary election. Voters now head to the polls in November's general election to decide who will be president. In Kansas, unofficial results from Tuesday's primary election show voters decided to protect abortion rights in the state's constitution. Kansas is the first state to vote on abortion since the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. Native women in the state were among those speaking out ahead of the election, concerned about abortion bans and access to birth control. Members of the Native community were also instrumental in holding voter registration drives and helping with voter education. A Native radio station on the Pine Ridge Reservation is kicking off a capital campaign for a new facility. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Lee Strubinger has more.
KILI Radio, or Keeley, has been on the air for nearly four decades. The station is located on Porcupine Butte in Porcupine, South Dakota. Keeley was the first American Indian-owned radio station in the United States. The original building was built by volunteers. It was constructed as a temporary facility. Bill Means is the board president for Keeley Radio.
Our radio station sort of outgrew its usefulness in the sense of modern-day equipment, in the sense of space for offices, and we needed a new home. And so this is the beginning of that adventure.
Keeley Radio is looking to build a $2.5 million facility. The station airs tribal council meetings, Lakota Nation Invitational basketball games, and a wide range of music, from traditional powwow music to country, rock and roll, and hip-hop. Keeley Radio is mostly powered by renewable energy, both wind and solar. Tom Casey is the station's general manager. He says the goal for the station is to generate 100% of its power from renewable energy.
Obviously, as a radio station, 100,000 watts, we use quite a bit of electricity. So our commitment was not only to us to be working and to bring in as much renewable energy as possible, but also show the community and show the region that it's possible, it's doable. Find the resources and let's commit to using as much renewable energy as possible.
Station officials have a goal of raising the money in 2 years. For National Native News, I'm Lee Strubinger.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Idaho Power is throwing some shade on rooftop solar, according to supporters. The power company wants to reduce the rate it pays to rooftop solar generators to the rate that customers actually pay for power. Eric Tegedov reports.
Idaho Power has commissioned a study that finds the rate it pays for rooftop solar customers to send their power back to the grid should be lowered. The Monopoly Energy Company sent its study to the Idaho Power Utilities Commission for consideration, suggesting net metering rates be cut by roughly 60%. Alex McKinley owns Empowered Solar in Boise and says the state has a great solar resource, but a cut in rates likely would hurt efforts to install panels on roofs.
Their goal as an investor-owned utility is to make profits, and they see residential distributed generation as a threat to their profits. And I think that comes out pretty clearly in the way this study was conducted.
Idaho Power says the reduction in rates are a matter of fairness. It says infrastructure costs, for example, are pushed onto other customers at the current net metering rate. The Idaho PUC is taking public comment on the study's results. Mike Engel chairs the Portneuf Resource Council in Southeast Idaho. He doesn't believe the suggested rates will kill the solar industry, but notes it will take longer for customers to pay off their systems. However, Engel says it would be best to motivate people to move toward rooftop solar with the current rates because it will protect the environment and also support local economies with jobs.
Idaho Power and the Public Utilities Commission should ensure that all of Idaho's residents have the ability to participate in Idaho Power's goal of migrating to clean energy.
Idaho Power has committed to using 100% renewable energy by 2045. Engel is pushing for a third party to evaluate the numbers in Idaho Power's study. McKinley says Idaho and other states are feeling the pressure from a changing climate, putting strain on energy grids.
Distributed generation makes the whole grid more resilient. And the public, whether they're someone who has rooftop solar or not, wants a more resilient grid.
For Northern Rockies News Service, I'm Eric Tegedov.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, August 4th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast. We encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips. Here's the number, 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Eleanor Trombla, Grant Button, and Eric Tegedoff. The producer's Annette Newell. Our engineer is Otto.